Duffy's Beer and much more in Pleasant Hills. 412-653-BEER. See all of our specials at duffysbeer.com. Duffy's has an amazing selection of craft and local beers, including some hard-to-find brews. They're also fully stocked on the supplies you need to make your own craft brew, over 40 varieties of hops and grains as well, and 30 varieties of yeast. Whether you're just starting out or you're an experienced brewer, Duffy's has you covered. Duffy's Beer and much more. Online at duffysbeer.com.
Duffy's Beer presents the morning show on Trib Live Radio featuring Ken Laird, Guy Junker, and Tim Benz. 294 Curry Hollow Road, 412-653-BEER. See all of our weekly specials at duffysbeer.com.
The Trib Live Radio Triple Threat.
He wants three. You know that's a trip, triple.
And Ken Laird, Guy Junker, and now Tim Benz right here on Trib Live Radio.
On a Duffy's Beer Football Friday here on Trib Live Radio.
You know, listening to Tim do that Duffy's commercial, Ken, reminded me that the two sounds I like the most is that sound of beer pouring into a glass and the sound of the sound of the golf ball circling around the cup, dropping into the cup. Two perfect sounds.
I thought we were going to say the lips of that redhead in St. Louis that kissed you while you were on the air. That was a smacker. We're always commercial-free in the 10 a.m. hour, and on a Football Friday, we start football. Bigger win, guys, on Monday, if we're talking about it. Pitt over Notre Dame. I'll throw Penn State in there, Guy, just to make you feel happy, over Northwestern. Or the Steelers over the Raiders. What's the bigger deal this weekend?
It's got to be the Steelers and Raiders.
I agree.
Because I know it's Notre Dame, and they've got cachet, and Pitt needs the win, wants the win for the sake of momentum. But
if they were playing Duke, there might be an argument.
In terms of conference impact, it's not there because Notre Dame, as Pat Narduzzi so adeptly pointed out during his radio show, is not in a conference, and they should be. And this is a huge win for the Steelers if they get it. This is a season-pivoting win, I think, if the Steelers get it. This could be a playoff-saving win if the Steelers get it. So I say it's the Steelers over the Raiders if that transpires.
I actually think the biggest college game this weekend is West Virginia-Texas Tech, because I think if West Virginia loses, Dana Holgorsen may be looking for work very soon.
Ooh, well, that's a good point. Joe Starkey wrote about the Pitt game today. I was with you guys until I read Joe's piece at TribLive.com. I think he changed my mind a little bit because we were talking about this Pitt game as, well, it doesn't really mean that much, right? It's all about the Coastal. But if you beat Pitt, you beat Notre Dame, you beat a top 10 team for the first time since 2008, you beat the Irish, you stop them from a national title run potentially, not to be overdramatic, but I guess they're fifth in the country, they've got very much a shot at it. That probably would be the lead story Monday morning, wouldn't
it? No, it won't be. Because there's still Pitt as opposed to the Steelers. This is a crucial game.
Just in terms of general interest, you know, 80% of the people around here are interested in the Steelers, 20 are interested in Pitt.
But that would be a win that would not be Pitt.
Yeah, but you just chronicled the reasons why it would be a big loss for Notre Dame. You didn't chronicle as many reasons for why it would be a big win for Pitt.
Yeah, but Notre Dame's Notre Dame. The guy used to, with his Catholic school buddies, idolize this team. Guys of his age, you know, coming up through the ranks. Maybe not so much anymore. It's a national story. More so than Steelers and Raiders. A couple of 4-4 team, giving another team a fourth loss. Could the Steelers lose this week and come back? Totally. Totally could. They bounce back and beat the Browns the next week. They'll be 5-5, and they'll be fine for a wild card
Pitt loses,
run.
It really has no effect on their chances of winning the ACC.
The Duke game is the bigger game for Pitt. I would buy this argument more if we were talking about Pitt-Duke, as strange as that sounds. But every reason that you and Joe are bringing up is why it's a big game for Notre Dame, not why it's a big game if Pitt wins it. As we pointed out yesterday when Pat Bostic was on with us, there have been a number of games against Notre Dame where they've pulled off surprising upsets, and what has that done for the program? They still are where they are.
But you know, were they ranked this highly at the
yes,
time?
Yes, Tyler Palko was effing proud of this football team, but you know, how much impact did that really have long term if you're going to turn around and lose to Rutgers 55-14 or you know whatever example you wanted to point to?
Those were mostly the Wanstead era, right? The one win, they went to 9-1, is that correct, when they beat them? I don't know what Notre Dame was ranked in any of those games. I don't think they were ranked fifth in the country, though. I'm almost positive.
No, I don't think any of them were as high as five.
So that's significant. I mean, you have a new coach who would have a signature win on his map.
What's the significance?
That you beat a big-time program, that you're un-Pitt, that for the first time in a long time you shocked somebody since the South Florida win back in 2008, where you had a national, you know, a ranked team coming in. And even that, it's South Florida. You know, how excited could you be about it?
See, I would look at this the same way as if Pitt were playing Duke and the winner would go to the ACC championship game and the Steelers were playing the Patriots. No, I mean, let me think of an NFC team that's undefeated. Let's say the Steelers were playing
Carolina,
now that the Packers have a loss, and they beat them. Or you know, and, yeah, it's great. They beat an undefeated team. You could say the first time since, you know, that late in the season, since 2003 or 4 or whatever it was. But in the grand scheme of what they're trying to accomplish for the year, it doesn't matter as much, whereas Pitt would have clinched a, you know what I mean? I just reverse it that way.
Well, yeah, as Joe writes, winning the Coastal would be nice, but all that's likely to get anybody is a lopsided loss to Clemson. I'm kind of with you, though, guys, if you're playing that game.
But if you don't play, if you don't think playing in the ACC championship game the first Saturday in December in Charlotte is a giant,
that'd be huge.
It's a giant step forward for this program if they can get to that.
Yeah, when I try to think about that in my mind's eye, you're right. That's a bigger build-up. There's hype for that game. There's buzz for it. We're talking about it all week. That probably
I think
we'd
be
bigger.
Talking about both. I think it's huge. But if you're talking about Monday, first of all, the Steeler game will be 24 hours fresher. There's a lot more people interested in the Steelers than in Pitt. And I think, you know, for where both teams want to eventually get this year, the Steeler game is more important.
Yeah.
Maybe for the, you know, the shiny ribbon on the package, the Notre Dame game might be a bit, you know, it's like one of those, wow, this is, you know, this is a nice wrapping paper, a big silver bow, and it's still socks and underwear when you open it up.
Is Dree Archer in the package?
Yeah, he's getting mailed out of town.
The Dree Archer experiment officially ends yesterday, and they admit that it's a bust, right? I mean, that's by their own admission. They just finally said, you're right, we blew it. Third-round pick down the drain. Sorry, fellas. And late in the week to boot, although I guess that's waiver wire related.
It's ironic to me that it comes in Raiders week, because what team, especially when Al Davis was alive, has been more in love with just pure speed, regardless of football ability and instincts, than
right.
The Oakland Raiders.
Good point.
They've been drafting guys for years because they can, you know, win the 440 relay.
Including Darius Hayward Bay, who's on the team currently.
Yeah, so the only thing about it is, I'm glad I've been calling for it like everybody else has. The only thing about it is, if this were Jacoby Jones 5 years ago, I'd be doing cartwheels into the office this morning. Archer actually, pardon me, has a better kickoff return average than Jacoby Jones this year.
Yeah. Uh-oh. Jones has not been good.
I don't think he's going to set the world on fire. But maybe they can get some use out of him as a receiver. Maybe as a punt returner, get Antonio Brown out of there. His numbers haven't been great this year anyway. Protect him a little bit. I wouldn't mind that. But I think it goes back to how difficult it is to really have to do much returning kickoffs now anyhow in the NFL the way it's set up. I mean, at best, you know, in the old days, nobody would take a kick 8 yards deep and try to run it out. Now they do, because it's the only chance you have to make something happen. But I can't think of anybody who's like setting the world on fire on kickoff returns right now.
Now, as I look at his stats on kick returns, he had 9 kick returns, Jacoby Jones, for 193 yards. That doesn't sound terrible. It doesn't sound like he's totally washed up. The punt returns, he was minus 4 yards on 5 returns. But he's not going to return punts here, right? So
probably not. But I would consider it. As I just said, if you can get AB a blow here, and his numbers haven't been great. If Antonio Brown was returning punts the way he did last year, it'd be worth it. For what you're getting out of him right now, is him getting hurt worth having him back there? I mean, it's still like I think 21 yards return for Jacoby Jones was 25 yards of return for Dree Archer. Is 4 yards really make that much of a difference? The thing that I see about it is there is nothing else for Dree Archer to do in this team. He didn't have a catch this year. He didn't have a carry. He averaged 4 yards a carry last year in the limited amount of runs that he got.
It's a shame because it is a third-round pick, and although that's not a guarantee, I mean, that's once you get to the round three, I guess you're 50% chance of success, but you would think more than a year and a half, and a year and a half of no impact. It brings back memories of the Craig Urbick pick, or Curtis Brown was a corner they drafted. They really got nothing out of. They've had a pretty sketchy mid-round history here of the last couple years in the draft, and they fully admit that Dree Archer was a bust. The trippiest thing about this, no pun intended, was the news.
Yes, pun intended, stop. Pun intended, extreme pun intended right there.
Okay. Jacoby Jones' former Pirate was making news at the same time that Jacoby Jones' new Steeler was making news yesterday. The Pirates prospect that they traded off of the Soria deal, who got popped for 50 games yesterday. It was like within a 10-minute span of yesterday on social media. So it was kind of a strange Thursday. But I guess, you know, my question would be that are Steelers fans ticked off about this, or did Tomlin make the right move? Or do you just look at it more as, I can't believe they wasted a third-round pick on Dree Archer?
I can't think a single Steeler fan would be upset that Dree Archer is gone. And I think Steeler fans look at Jacoby Jones and remember what he has done to them in the past and what he's done in big games in the past and hope there's something still there. And if worse comes to worse and there's a couple injuries during the game, you can put Jacoby Jones out at wide receiver. He's not going to do much for you, but at least you can do it and feel like you have a potential weapon there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the average fan looks at it as, I can't believe they wasted a pick on that guy. You know, how would you like to have had a cornerback with that pick, whoever was available around that point in the draft?
Yeah. And you can always go back and pick out a couple names, but that's so recent, it's like these guys haven't even blossomed yet, I'm sure a lot of them. The 2014 NFL draft, Dree Archer, pick number 97.
I mean, I blame all this on Chris Rainey. If he wouldn't have gotten in trouble, they would never would have had to take him.
Well, if he didn't suck either, because, yeah. You know, he was basically Dree Archer before Dree Archer was Dree Archer. He was supposed to be a tool that they could use. He was supposed to be perfect for Todd Haley's offense. He had pure speed. He was going to be able to return kicks. And he stunk, too, besides his personality off the field, and besides the fact he was dumber than a box of rocks and couldn't pick up the offense. This guy was supposed to be good, and he just didn't have any talent either.
Two picks after Dree Archer, the Ravens took Crockett Gilmore, pretty useful tight end as we've seen so far. And six picks later, the Atlanta Falcons took Devonta Freeman, the running back from Florida State, who's having a hell of a year. I mean, you could do that for any draft, but there are a couple that they missed on. And a year and a half later, Dree Archer cut. You can email the show on Duffy's Beer Friday, sportstalk@tribweb.com. You guys were chatting with the coordinators, and Tim, you brought up Keith Butler taking a little, or Narduzzi taking a little jab, rather. Keith Butler, you got off his game with one of your questions yesterday.
Well, first, let's play the Arthur Motes clip. The mini. Do we have that there, Josh? This is not the full interview. I'm talking about the individual clip. This is what Arthur Motes had to say when I asked him. Remember Tomlin brought up the tight ends that the Oakland Raiders have? They've got Walford, who wears number 88, sort of their combo guy.
That's the rookie, right?
Rivera, he's more of the pass catcher. He wears number 81. And then there's Lee, who's the blocker. He wears 86. So just kind of keep your eyes on those numbers as they come into the game, because the way Mike Tomlin described it, three different guys that do three very different things. So I brought that up to Motes and asked him, you know, is there a little bit of a tell here with the tight ends and what the Raiders do?
One area where you guys did a lot better was against the tight ends this past week, and they've got a good one in Eifert.
Mm-hmm.
Oakland seems to rotate three different guys there, and the way Mike described it was there are three different guys with three very different styles.
Yes.
One guy's a pure blocker, another one's a move-the-change guy, and then there's another guy's sort of like an H-back combo.
Yeah, that's very true, and the thing is, you know, those three guys, they tell you a story. So, you know, the biggest thing is you have to just study their film and study what they do with those three different guys, because like you said, they're three totally different personalities. So, you know, it's going to give us some clues and things like that, but it's going to be on us to capitalize on it.
So in other words, he's saying, yes, whenever they change tight ends, we know what's coming, or we should know what's coming. So
is he Todd Graham? Is he basically saying we're stealing signs? and we're loving it?
So I brought it up to Keith Butler, and I said, Coach, you know, and I think Will Allen kind of echoed that as well. I didn't mention the players by name, but I said a couple of your players in the locker room were expanding on what Mike said about the tight ends. Is there a tell with what the Oakland Raiders do when they put their tight ends out there? Listen to this clip, and I'll tell you what the facial reaction was afterwards if you can't figure it out on your own.
Mike pointed out during his press conference they got three different tight ends that do three very different things.
Right.
And a couple of the players yesterday mentioned that you can learn a lot by looking at their formations given who's out there. Is there a tell with what they do there with their tight ends?
I'll leave that one alone. We'll see if there are or not. I'll talk to you about it after the game, okay?
There was literally a, I just sucked on a lemon look on his face, or like he had just been stung by a bee.
You became Bob Holtzman in that moment, reporting on...
Kind of, but I just was taking back quotes of what the players said. I didn't.
He probably went straight to those guys and said, stop telling these guys his stuff.
But I didn't mention the names. So Arthur, Will, I didn't air you out. Maybe Keith Butler saw who I was talking to in the locker room and figured it out on his own, but I just said some of your players. I put it out there that way, generically.
If you don't think the mugshot of Tim Benz has made its way around the clubhouse already, around the locker room, don't talk to this guy. Probably handed out by Labriola, but maybe by the coaches in addition. I could see how that would put him on edge if they think that is a big deal about the game.
Ooh, why did they say that?
Saying their guard was down?
When I used the word tell, because it's obvious that's the word that he used to them, and now they're barking it back up to me. He just looked at me like, ooh, don't, please just stop. Turn your recorder off, you little shit.
Well, I'm glad they have tells. I hope they can shut this team down for their sake. I got my doubts. What do you guys think? Was this defense up to the challenge?
Oh, after hearing that soundbite, I'm now convinced that the blocker, Lee, number 86, is going to go for six catches and 85 yards or something. Move the chains five times on four-yard passes.
The strange thing is, last night, Eifert goes for three touchdowns and the Bengals win. They did a better job on him, who looks like baby Gronk, than they did on three or four tight ends that are of less name variety in the league this year.
Yeah, we mentioned it after the Cincinnati game. The tight ends for the Bengals, in essence, had one drive. They had that drive where the backup, whatever his name was, I don't even remember what his name was, had the big 23-yard reception. Then Eifert, shortly after, had two more catches, including one of 24 yards.
Yeah.
Eifert had one catch for 6 yards midway through the third quarter. The Bengals launched that drive, and it was almost entirely tight end related for three catches to get them
Hewitt,
down the field.
Hewitt was the other guy.
And then they disappeared again. So it was one drive that the Bengal tight ends had, and that was it against the Steeler defense, who had been awful against good tight ends earlier in the year.
But the Bengals win anyway, and they're 8-0 now after last night's win. This is the thing, guy, that I got the toughest in my brain picking apart. We're going to pick this game for picking pork, obviously, at noon today, the Steelers-Raiders. But can the Steelers defense, can Keith Butler's boys do what they've done to a lot of teams, to their credit, hold them to their lowest output of the year, and rise up to the challenge? Or will the Raiders put 30 on him this week? And I don't know the answer to that. I think they're going to do a decent job, but would it shock you to see Crabtree and Amari Cooper and Latavius Murray and these three tight ends carving them up? Not really.
No. I mean, why would it? Because they've had good numbers.
Yeah.
I think they've done a little bit of that with smoke and mirrors, don't you? I mean, they've given up a lot of yardage and been pretty good at, coming up. How many different turnovers have they? How many red zone turnovers have they had this year? At least two picks in the end zone or near the
bunch.
End zone.
Yeah, I mean, Carson Palmer's.
You can't keep counting on that. I mean, that's great, but I mean, to me, that's not the same as, for example, Cincinnati is one of the best teams in the NFL at red zone defense. Period, and theirs is more by sacking the guy out of. Field goal range, or giving up a field goal instead of a touchdown, not by coming up with an interception at the goal line, which I think is great if you can do it, but not something you can count on.
Yeah. Well, you asked Butler yesterday, guy, a question about the Raiders' offense and some of their numbers, and I thought that was an interesting response from Butler. Or you were asking about the Raiders' D, actually. You were asking Haley about the Raiders' defense. I'll take that back. But,
well, they give up over 300 passing yards a game, so they're second in the NFL in run defense, but that's one of those because nobody runs on them because they throw all over them. And he said to me, I don't see people throwing all over them. I mean, they may pile up 300 yards, but they're fighting for every 7 or 8 yards they get against them.
Well, here's Butler talking about Carr. If it wasn't you, it was one of the other guys asking him about whether Carr's legit, and he pretty much said yes, he is.
I think he plays pretty good. He looks like a lot like his brother. I think he's got a good arm. He's got good mobility. They got a good offense. They're ninth in the league in offense, and they're scoring some points. They're 4-3 for a good reason. They play in a very good division. Had the opportunity to play in that division. That's a tough division. So it's they got a good football team, and I hope people don't underestimate them. We don't.
Good to know it was a tough division 35 years ago when Keith was playing with the Seahawks.
He was funny talking about Al Davis. Did you get that clip too? When it comes to the Al Davis rivalry, listen to this one as well, Ken.
Yeah.
Al Davis would always go down there and stand on your end zone where you're doing all your warm-ups and sit there and cross his arms. he was gonna whoop somebody's butt or something, you know. But that's the way he was. He enjoyed the game. He enjoyed the physical part of the game. He enjoyed the psychological part of the game, and that was Al.
Fine Syracuse man, psychological part of the game, Ken.
Who's a Syracuse man?
Al Davis.
Oh, Al Davis.
Yeah. Had those Seahawks questioning themselves before every game.
Did Mental Jerry Jones warfare. Go there too? Did all the Crypt Keepers go to the same college?
No, Jerry Jones was Arkansas.
Okay.
You know, the official alma mater of Josh Taylor over here.
Well, the Jets last week got burned for 34 points. I thought their defense was good. There was a stat from ESPN Stats and Info that the Jets blitzed 61% of the time last week, and Carr did well. He threw 3 touchdowns against the blitz.
Well, so saying he's a lot like his brother isn't necessarily
a compliment. That's true.
Their dad was a coach too, wasn't he? The Carrs, I think their dad might have coached them. I think they were sons of a coach. I think he's better than his brother.
Hopefully he's more mobile to avoid all the sacks his brother took in his first 2 years.
Their schedule's been tough. They've played 2 undefeated teams and lost to both of them. It's hard for me to – I still think it's hard for a team to come from the West Coast and play a 1 o'clock game here. I think that's an advantage. But for whatever reason, I mean, Roethlisberger's 1-4 against this organization in his life, and Tomlin's 1-3. They've been a pain in their ass for a long time with teams that were a lot less talented than this one. So going back to your original question, Ken, I do fear the Raiders.
I do too. Now, if you beat them, you put them at 4-4, and the Steelers go to 5-4, and you're feeling pretty good about things Monday because all of a sudden the Jets are still without Fitzpatrick, although I guess he's going to play. I guess maybe they're not without him. But, you know, we'll see what the Jets do this weekend. They're 4-3, and everybody else has 3 wins or fewer in the wild card race.
I'm not
going to
be feeling great. I'm going to be feeling better. I would be feeling lousy if they lost. Lousy about their chances.
Yeah. Lousy is a stretch.
Sooner or later, you have got to look at their record in the AFC. I mean, that, you know what it's going to be like going into the last weekend. There's going to be all these scenarios, and they're going to be on the outside looking in on all of them because they're going to be 2-6 in the AFC. I mean, they got to win some games in this conference so they have something to back up a tie.
Did you catch any of the Thursday night game last night, guys, the Browns-Bengals?
Yeah, I watched a lot of it.
I'm sure Manziel will start next week against the Steelers now after at least putting together a drive or two.
Wow, I'm not. His second half was awful. I think he had 1 first down in the second half, Ken. Yeah, he put together that 92-yard drive end of first half there in the game, and I'm thinking the same thing. And who did the color last night?
Aikman.
No, it was
not Aikman. I'm sorry.
It was Boomer, wasn't it?
No, it was
Sims.
Sims.
That's right. He was saying that he, you know, after the first half, he thought that probably meant that he would get a. If he could have played a representative game and either beaten Cincinnati or played well against them in a close loss, he might have had a chance to get a start with the Steelers. But he thought the second half was so awful that wouldn't happen. That's what he said anyway.
I'm just thinking from their organizational point of view, you drafted this guy where you did. Your coach is probably, that's his one reason he might keep his job, is that he could say, I got a young quarterback, we're developing. And you saw enough in the 192-yard drive that you thought he's got something in there. We got to work on it.
His drop, he like is tiptoeing backwards. He looks terrible when he drops back to throw. I mean, you know, he could throw the ball, but I don't think his mechanics and footwork are NFL caliber right now.
Yeah, I don't either. But what I'm saying is that's a win for the Steelers. They're going to beat Manziel next week at Heinz Field. So you lose to the Raiders. I know what you're saying, Tim. You feel terrible about it. But then you're 5-5 after that one.
Boy, how long can you keep saying? But then you're 5-5. Then you're 6-6. You do this, and you're 7-7. At what point do you stack a couple wins? Here's what you got staring at you after Cleveland: Seattle, Indy, Cincy, and Denver. Seattle has underachieved at 4-4. Indy may not be great, but they're not terrible. And Cincy and Denver are both undefeated. Yeah, that's another, at best, 500.
2-2, yeah.
Yeah, so you're 5-5. So now if you're going 2-2 there, you're 7-7. That's not a playoff team.
I know this.
9-7 might be.
I've got 3 games circled on the calendar that I think would be very difficult for the Steelers to win. The Bronco game, the Bengal game, at St. Louis. That's 3 losses. They need to go 5-3 to at least be 9-7. And be in the playoff hunt.
9-7, I think, gets them in, based on what I'm seeing now with the schedule.
At St. Louis, what? You lost me for a second.
At Seattle,
Oh, you said at St. Louis. Okay.
Oh, sorry. At Seattle, right.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I agree with you.
Denver.
People look at Seattle and think, oh, they're 4-4. They're going to go out there and win. That is a very – that's the loudest place in the NFL and a very tough place to play. And I think they're better than 4-4 because I think the Steelers are better than 4-4 too. Now, here's what I fully expect. I think the offense is going to be – you know, I don't think Le'Veon Bell being out is going to like – it's like a complete flat tire that this is going to suddenly – I still think they're healthier right now. If they're going to be affected by injury, it'll be more along the offensive line. There certainly was my line of questioning with Haley yesterday was in better shape to replace Bell now than they were a year ago, especially with what he did to 127 yards against the Patriots. He had 3 touchdowns against the 49ers. But I think the defense is going to regress a little because I do believe they've done it a little bit with smoke and mirrors, as I said. With maybe you can continue creating those turnovers, but I think it's going to be more of the same in the second half, just with a different color.
Your emails at sportstalk@tribweb.com. This one from Matt. He says it's about time they cut Dre Archer, guys. He's done absolutely nothing. He couldn't even kneel down for a touchback on most returns. I believe Tomlin and Haley drafted him because Colbert would never have done something like that in the third round. How can a third-round pick on offense only have 63 yards from scrimmage in 20 or so games? The problem is he didn't play much on offense.
He was a waste. There's no doubt about it. The funny thing is they were using a lot of Dre Archer in practice yesterday. I don't know if you guys noticed
that. Oh, with the first team, too?
Yeah.
Near the end of practice. Yeah.
Yeah, they were running him like crazy, and a lot of us in the media were like, are they planning to use him because Bell is hurt? That looks awful.
Is that the Dan Bylsma plan after he was like when he was in limbo? the Penguins were using him to run copies or something for that week he was around. That's pretty rough.
He was.
I feel bad for the guy personally. I mean, don't want to see anybody lose their job, but
yeah, I don't care.
It's time to go.
I don't care.
I think he'll land somewhere. He'll get another chance, and maybe in a different system, maybe do something. And if he fails, then he'll go. I don't think he's going on those life's work yet.
You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here.
Sam's Dre Archer's life's work really will be.
I don't know. Tom will call
him. You know
what?
I don't think I've talked to him since his first training camp very early on.
I talked to him once, and I don't remember a single moment of the conversation. I just remember it being brief and very non-stimulating.
Tomlin compared him to the imp from Game of Thrones, so he's got that going for him. Sam's Drunk Dog emails and says,
how'd the Game of Thrones wind up? I mean, since I ruined Walking Dead, should you watch Game of Thrones, Ken? You want to tell us how the
It's not done
ended?
Yet.
Oh, okay. All right.
It's another season to come. By the way, did you not blow the last episode of The
what
Walking Dead? Is the guy that you said was whacked not whacked? Or is that blowing the episode, too?
Glenn. His name is Glenn. Let's refer to the dead properly, Ken.
But he might not be dead, is what I've been
but
seeing
I said
on
that
social media.
The first day anyway. People started tweeting that. It's a setup. There's somebody else in there. It's somebody else's guts that got ripped out. You wait. He'll be back. Like, I don't give a shit. You're the one that's watched the show and caring about it.
So cold and callous. And yet you'll be like smiling with glee when the new Star Wars trailer comes out today.
Is there another Star Wars trailer that's coming out today?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I was unaware of this. That's big.
Sam's Drunk Dog emails. Dre Archer sucked, but the lack of the return game had a lot to do with bad blocking and the kicker's ability to kick the ball past the end zone. He didn't get many opportunities. I guess he didn't. Nobody does anymore. You pointed that out, Guy. I mean, but still, you're hoping for a little bit of a punch, you know, not a return to the 15-yard line when you do get a rare opportunity.
Yeah, and the other part of it is he's made some bad decisions. He's taking the ball 8 yards deep and trying to get out with it, and then he kneels with it 2 yards deep when you could get a return out of him.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit of Penguins here, guys, in the first hour. Commercial free, as always, on Trib Live Radio. They're back in action tonight when the Western Canadiens swing. But maybe more importantly, Sidney Crosby responded to the Mike Babcock net bigger stance. This made the rounds, of course, across the NHL circles yesterday. It's a pretty big deal, right? You have a significant, highest-paid coach in the league calling for the nets to be made bigger. He would not have been the guy that I would have expected to call for that. And I would not have expected either the way Marc-Andre Fleury and Sidney Crosby responded about this. They basically took your side, Guy, that they don't want to see the nets touched. And yet they both agreed.
Great, we all fail together.
They both agreed, right, that... they thought the pads and the goalie equipment could be altered, and that includes Fleury, who was talking about this. So I don't know if that's a surprise to you guys, but for a goaltender in the league, for Fleury to say, yeah, I'd like to see them, they could cut down on some of the size of the pads a little bit.
I think most guys are confident enough when they've reached that level in their own ability that as long as everybody's using the same stuff, they're fine with it. I don't know if I made myself clear enough yesterday. My point about college basketball is, they, and it has slowed down in recent years, but what they've done is changed some rules to speed it up, not the equipment. They're not making the hoop higher. They don't, you know, I don't want to see physical changes to the equipment used in the, not equipment's a bad word, because I do want to see it to, in goaltenders, to the, you know, I'd like to know where 4x6 originally came up. Where, you know, you could look at football today with the way it's slung around in the NFL and say, hey, let's make the field 130 yards. It's too easy to score touchdowns now with the way teams pass. You know, where did 100 yards originally become, you know, where did 90 feet come from in baseball? I don't know where that, but to me, that's really messing with the real
tradition, the fiber
of the game and the way it was invented. Yeah, because the players have gotten bigger and the equipment's gotten better. I would just rather see rule changes, or in hockey especially, the rules called the way they're set up, and it would be a lot better. I think there are other things to try. Have you tried some of these things? Have you insisted on smaller goaltending pads? Have you really held your referees to the fire and said, call these penalties, and you still had the same product? Then maybe you have to consider something beyond that.
People like you are traditionalists about the game have also used the phrase that you did yesterday, which is you can just throw the rule book out. But, you know, we have
the record book.
The record book, yeah. The mound was changed in baseball.
I was thinking about that last night, too, yeah.
The three-point line was moved to different lengths in basketball. You know, so there have been – the goalposts got moved to the back of the end zone in football. So they have done stuff like that. It wouldn't be the most unprecedented move in sports to make the nets slightly bigger. They've moved the hashes in. They moved the hashes out in football.
Well, they've moved the nets around. They've given you more room behind the net, less room behind the net. Changed
it sounds
the
dramatic.
From a rectangle to a...
It sounds like they'd be widening the hoop in basketball or something, right? Or making the net bigger in soccer. I don't know if we've ever seen anything quite like that, where the goal itself is altered.
Right.
So I can understand how people think it sounds dramatic. Here's Crosby's quote to NBC. I'm kind of a traditionalist. I would rather see the goalies get smaller equipment before the nets get bigger. I'd rather try that, but I'm all for more goals, however you want to do it, end quote.
And part of the reason I think that Fleury is more welcoming of the notion of having smaller goalie equipment than the average goalie is because he is so athletic, and what he does to distinguish himself from other goalies is about movement within the net and getting from point A to point B. So other goalies probably try to make themselves bigger just to take up more room because they're not as quick, they're not as agile. So I might as well be the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man.
True.
And Fleury, I think, if things are all equal across the board, he could have smaller equipment and still be closer of a replication of the goaltender we know now because he's got his own athleticism to make up for it.
That's a good point. This is advantage Fleury if this happens. He says, quote, I think there's some stuff in the goalie gear they could maybe round up so guys aren't so boxy and big. I think the nets have been the same for so many years. Growing up in the same nets with the same angles, it would be a little weird to change that, end quote.
You know, and we talked about that on a day that, like I said, I really took notice of the Les Binkley still picture that they put up for the first shutout in Penguin history, how small the blocking pad is, which is made out of leather. I mean, the catching glove in those days was a glorified first baseman's mitt. Now that thing, my God, you could catch an aircraft carrier in those things.
You could. But the game has changed a lot in terms of the way it's played, too, right? I mean, if you watch some of the highlights from the Les Binkley days, the time and space that these players get as they come up the ice is incredible, right? You just watch Bobby Orr skate. I mean, I know he was a great player, but nobody's hitting him in the neutral zone or coming back in the trap to try to clog
right.
it up so he can't
but I
get
think
his
if
move
I think if you took today's players in general, if you just picked up today's Dallas Stars and plopped them on a rink against the 1967 Toronto Maple Leafs, I think they'd win 6-0. They'd be blowing pucks by stand-up goalies who stand with their back against a crossbar whose leg pads come up to the top of their knees.
Right.
It is kind of funny. Like, you go back and watch highlights of the great Penguin teams from the 90s, or if you flip on Nesson and you see the old 70s Bruins, or Comcast Philly and they're showing highlights of the old Philadelphia Flyers, the game just it looks like you're watching a different sport with the where the goalies stand, how they flail at the puck, how much room there is in the ice, you know, the speed of the players, but at the same time the goals that are being scored, they don't look as fast, but there's more ice to be had at times. It's just it's weird watching old hockey highlights, stranger than it is to throw on a highlight of a
the weirdest thing
game.
Is seeing white dasher boards with no advertising.
Yes, there's that too.
Well, yeah, to that point, I was watching SportsCenter this morning, and Barry Melrose gets, you know, 2 minutes to talk about the NHL, but they always talk about, you know, Ovechkin or some of the stars, but they were showing the highlights from the Capitals game last night, and Ovechkin scored a goal in front of the net where the puck came in, and he lifted the stick of Zdeno Chara, and he was on his side, and he put one in, and Melrose was gushing about him. He's like, this is why I love Ovechkin. This is why he scores 50 goals every year. He always goes to the tough areas. And I guess maybe he's got a point in terms of, like, comparing him to Crosby. You don't see Sid posting up in front. That's not his game necessarily. But is that why Ovechkin has been more prolific in the goal-scoring department lately?
I don't think of Ovechkin as being a guy who goes to the tough areas and posts up to score goals. You think about Ovechkin on the power play. You think about
Ovechkin. Stands where Sid does, near the circle and blasts.
Yeah. You think about Ovechkin on the rush. And I don't think about Ovechkin being Rick Tocchet, you know, and taking a beating in front of the net.
Well, first of all, even comparing those two, and I guess Milbury didn't. Did you say Milbury said this?
Melrose. Yeah, he didn't bring up Crosby. That's just that.
First of all, you have to be realistic about it. Sid's had the crap beaten out of him to the point where his career almost ended. If he's a little bit shy of that, you can't blame him. And just look at the body types. I mean, you know, when John Steigerwald was on this show, he basically accused Ovechkin of being a steroid user. That guy's chest is as big around as a Buick's trunk. He's enormous. He can go, you know, when you have that body type, you can play that way. If Sid, I think Sid's got to pick and choose his spots. You know, there have been a lot of, Marty San Luis wasn't afraid to get his nose dirty, but you got to float in there and float out of there. Guys that size can't go in there and just stand there like Phil Esposito did and say, I'll stand here till somebody knocks me out of here because you'll be in the hospital by Tuesday.
Right, including Zdeno Chara, who cross-checked him in the chops in that playoff series, and Sid probably wasn't the same for the rest of the playoff series because they didn't officiate that. But it is stunning to see the, you know, the goal totals in an era where, I mean, I guess like Sagan has put up some good numbers, but the last 2 years, Ovechkin had 53, 51 the year before that. He's got a 65-goal season. What does he do that Sid can't? It's the shot, which is definite, but it also is that physicality, which is paying off for him in the goal department in a tough league to score.
I'll ask you this, too. Do you think Ovechkin still has closer to the same speed that he had when he came in the league as opposed to Crosby?
Crosby, I don't know. Is probably slower. Not as much.
Say it. Crosby is slower.
I think he is.
I would say Crosby was faster when they both came in, but Ovechkin has maintained more of what he has than Sid.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, when I say Crosby is slower, I don't know if he's slower in a flat-out foot race. I'm saying Crosby is slower than what Crosby was.
Well, I often wonder, Tim, and I don't know, is Crosby's slowness. I see the decision-making process doesn't seem as lightning quick as it did. Has the even a half a second when you're talking about NHL players, if his cognitive functions have slowed down the tiniest bit due to, and I don't know if this is even part of what happens after multiple concussions. Seems likely if he's just his decision-making has slowed the tiniest bit, it makes him a lot more average.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Ovechkin, he's had some downtime. There was a piece on Yahoo Sports about this, Tim, you pointed out to me, comparing the two. And it writes, remember when Ovechkin had those seasons in which he only scored 30 goals twice in a row? Everybody in Pittsburgh was delighted, and people were saying, I bet he's off steroids now, but then he was back to 50 goals.
I think that was more the coaching change there.
Maybe it was.
Trying to make him defensively responsible.
He was benched for a game or two, right?
And he wasn't out there on the power play or with the goalie pulled late in the game, and he got all pissed off, remember?
But anyway, this writer says, what's more likely, that Crosby has become an average player or that he's going through a difficult stretch of his career and will still figure out a way to put up mega points once again in the near future? I know what answer I'd go with, but I'm not personally disappointed in anybody as I write this.
And I understand what he's writing there. and I think the writer was Ryan Lambert, right, from Puck Daddy. But I think that Guy's point, if you're going to draw the comparison in this regard to Ovechkin and Crosby, you can't ignore, as he does in this comparison, what Guy just brought up. You know, the large reason why Ovechkin diminished statistically was because he was being asked to play a totally different style in a totally different way. Now, you could say that's what Crosby is being asked to do now.
And some people have said that, militant and, you know, the system that Johnson's got to play in.
I mean, that's where, if you want to talk about comparing the two and the slumps that they've had, then that's the point that you've got to compare on, not some of the other stuff.
Not that it's just he's in a slump and he'll come out of it.
Right. I don't think that Ovechkin was just in a slump, but he came out of it. I think the style and the approach of the entire team that is being asked to play in was the biggest reason why he was slumping. And maybe that's the reason for Crosby, too. However, I feel like when Ovechkin put himself in an opportunity to bury chances, he did a better job of that than what Crosby is doing now.
The one other thing, too, for Ovechkin's never won a championship, and I think is a very selfish player. All you have to do is look at his shot totals. If Sid shot as much as he did, how many, you know, and that's great. I mean, the ultimate thing is scoring a goal, not piling up assists, not, you know, winning faceoffs. I mean, all those things are part of the game, but scoring a goal is the best thing that you can do as a hockey player, always, unless you're a goalie. And he never passes up an opportunity. I think Sid has passed up way too many to the point of, you know, us questioning whether it was the residual effects of his wrist bothering him or whatever. You know, the one three-point game he had this year, he had 9 shots on goal that game. And, you know, Ovechkin has led the league or been near the top of the league in shots on goal almost every year of his career.
The Penguins went down there and beat them. And Fleury was the number one star of the game. What do you think about the Capitals this year? They're not like a favorite to win the Cup, I wouldn't say, but they are interesting. They added Oshie. They added Justin Williams.
Yeah.
They got Orpik and Niskanen in there. They got a pretty good offensive punch from the blue line with Carlson and Orlov and a couple guys. I mean, they've never gotten past the second round, so it's hard to take them seriously. But maybe this is the best chance Ovechkin's got to win a Cup.
Well, they got in the finals against the Red Wings.
Yeah, I mean, in the Ovechkin era, they have not.
Oh, okay.
I don't think they've won more than one round since Ovechkin's been there.
Yeah, the East is pretty open. I think if you're competitive in the East, you have as much reason to believe as the next team. I don't think you're going to see that wide of a disparity between the teams at the top of the Eastern Conference that get into the postseason and the teams that scrape in as the wild cards.
I'm expecting Montreal to cool off a little bit after a month of play. It doesn't look like anybody can touch them, including the Rangers right now.
Right,
but I think I would if you would have asked me this on October 5th, Ken, I would have had Washington as a possible finalist in the East
with the Rangers, maybe
with the Rangers. I would not have had Montreal in there, probably.
Maybe the Islanders.
Nah, I don't think not as a finalist. Not Boston anymore either.
No.
I might have had Columbus in there based on the way they finished last year and starting the season healthy, which shows you what the hell I know.
They won last night. Torts has got them fired. It was a nasty game they played last night with probably Torts at the helm of it. Two quick notes. We'll get back to some football stuff here. Jason Mackey's in British Columbia covering the game tonight in Vancouver. He talked to Rutherford about he's got a good tie-in with Rutherford. That's like his boy. As much as Rossi and Rutherford hate each other, Jason Mackey and Rutherford are like best buddies. Anyway, though, he writes...
Well, Rutherford, he knew he needed one buddy over here, so he had to latch on to somebody.
Oh, good.
Does Mackey sell ice cream, too, or...?
Not yet. Oh, okay. Season ain't over, though. Anyway, but Mackey says it won't be long before Derek Pouliot returns. Although he was cited for public drunkenness on Sunday, Rutherford called it a, quote, unfortunate but serious situation. It needs to be dealt with internally, but it doesn't affect how we view him. Certainly, if there's a recurrence, that's a different story, but this is the first time he's had any issues.
You just got to tip better.
Tip the cab.
You know, you're going to see...
Well, he didn't pay at all, according to this story. It was
right.
An unpaid cab fare.
The Wilkes-Barre Scranton Baby Penguins brought to you by Uber, because you pay everything in advance. There are no, you know, everything is done on the app. You have to worry about these problems. At least he kept his clothes on, as opposed to Nathan Smith. I think that's the important thing to focus on.
What's he blowing his money on at Wilkes-Barre if he can't afford the cab fare? Or is he just that cheap?
Or maybe he spent all of his money at the club. And I'll leave that open-ended.
The club, yeah. And also, Rutherford said he's okay with Daniel Sprong continuing to sit. He says,
why?
Quote, I don't think for his development or getting the best out of his game, he has to play 82. Right now, we have everybody healthy. Who comes out? Plotnikov is adjusting. As far as Sprong's development, just watching Wednesday, all he went through and how tough that workout was and the coach is pushing him, at this point in time, the NHL is the best place for his development. We're not putting any time frame on it. End quote.
Well, I wrote a piece for InsidePittsburghSports.com about Eric Fair that should go up later today, and it was in response to a couple of the emails that we've gotten, a phone call to local talk shows or two, a tweet or two. I'm not suggesting this is the majority opinion or I've heard a ton of it. I've just heard, you know, one email was too many. I've heard five or six about Fair, two games in, hey, let's elevate him to Geno's line. And you know how fans react when they see something bright, shiny, and new. It's like a cat with catnip, right? And you just think about what you can do with this, what your team has figured out that nobody else has, the fourth-round draft pick, the free agent signee. Hey, we've got this guy in our system, and he can do more than what he's doing right now. You don't want Eric Fair to do more than what he's doing right now. He was brought here for scoring depth, and you don't want to elevate him and then eliminate the depth. If they do trade Perron and or Kunitz and create a spot on that second line, that's where Sprong should go. With Geno Malkin, to play with other skilled players. Fair is good where Fair is. Let Fair be where he is. Killing penalties, two-way play, busting his ass on defense, and if on occasion a puck should land in his stick in transition and he buries it like he has in the first two games, great. But you brought him here for defense first and for scoring depth. You don't elevate the depth and eliminate the depth by putting him on one of the top two lines.
Unless you want to double shift them from here and there throughout a game, I'd be fine with that. Like a little cameo, like, you know, like in a pinch. You want to throw them up there to give Sid a little different dynamic than Dupuis?
All right, well, that's fine, but I don't think that's what people are suggesting. Like, oh, he scored twice in two games.
Yeah, you're
put
right.
Put him with Geno! You know, who won the Rocket Richard Trophy with Geno?
Hey, maybe you would. Ed tweets in.
He scored 20 goals once in his career. And like you said, it came with Jason Chimera as
his
center.
Well, that's my point. He's never played with a great Geno.
The Penguins are the perfect example of a team that piling up tons of talent doesn't necessarily make a great line. Look at their power play. It struggles with a man advantage and these great players out there. Like I said yesterday, should they have moved Jordan Staal up onto the first or second line when he was the third center on this team? That's a big reason why they won the Stanley Cup when they had three strong centers down the middle. For years, they thought, well, we'll just grab wings every year to match up with these centers. You don't just move all of your best guys onto the first line.
Although last year, I thought they moved Sutter up too late, and then when they did move him up in the playoffs, he looked like he had a little spark when he was playing up on the wing. And like Vancouver's playing him on the wing now, on the top two lines.
Well, first of all, let Fair play 10 games before you make any decisions on him.
That's
right. He has two shorthanded goals now. I would be willing to bet he'll have two at the end of the year.
Oh, ye of little faith.
I mean, shorthanded goals are rare.
Ed says, Ovechkin, guys, is rarely near the net when I watch him. He scores mostly from 25 to 40 feet away.
Yeah.
Sid has no shot like that, and very few do. I see him in front of the net a good bit. I think he, maybe not like posting up so much, but he's not bashful. I mean, the guy is not afraid of contact. You can't say that about him.
Well, there's a big difference between saying he's not afraid of contact and making it sound like, you know.
Yeah, he's not Tim Kerr. I mean,
yeah.
I hear that. Brian M. says, hopefully when Mike Tomlin sees Jacoby again today, he tries to trip him just for fun. I wonder how their first meeting would go. Chuck in Bethel Park says, Dree Archer is going to end up in New England as a Dion Lewis hybrid. You watch.
Oh, believe me, I've thought of that already.
No, that's not true.
Yep, I've thought of it already. Watch Bill Belichick grab this guy and make something out of him. He'll be an offensive Mike Vrabel.
Dion Lewis had a lot more talent than this guy did. Dion Lewis was pretty good at Pitt.
Dion Lewis is a real running back.
Well, I think if you take a look, I mean, Le'Veon Bell is a tremendous God-given talent, too. I don't make it sound like he's all knowledge, but just look at these two guys and the instincts. There's so much in sports that's instinct. You know, we've all talked, even in hockey, They're a guy, you know, Eddie Johnson, to me, still one of the funniest quotes ever, but this Jim Magoo guy the Penguins had, who should have been in the Ice Capades. He was such a great skater. He says, oh, if they didn't have boards on the end of the rink, he'd skate out onto Fifth Avenue, which there wouldn't be Fifth Avenue, it'd be Center Avenue, but that made it even more funny. But the point is, even straight ahead speed in hockey, you know, that isn't as important as quickness. Quickness is more important than speed. And you look at the patience which Le'Veon Bell and the instincts that he has when he has the ball. The game-winning touchdown against the Chargers, the perfect example. Archer doesn't show any of that. He looks to me like he's a track star. He's Gene Washington. We'll put him on first base to steal second, and he never gets the bat.
Yeah. Killer Chihuahua emails, and by the way, we got Rob Rossi coming up at 11. Killer Chihuahua says, that petulant Rossi's going to have to find doom and gloom elsewhere besides the Penguins for the time being. They keep winning. Yeah, they indeed. And
start covering
also,
the Steelers then if they lose to the Raiders.
Chihuahua says, Johnny Football sucks. He's too small, and as long as you keep him in the pocket, he can't see, and he just panics.
I agree with that.
He does want to get out of the pocket as soon as possible.
I hated the notion of Manziel in the NFL from Jump Street.
That 92-yard drive looked good, though. You don't think he could be a Russell Wilson if they get a good team around him?
It's a two-minute drive against first half
it's the
defense.
Bengals.
Yeah, but every team allows points in a two-minute drive. Every team. Scoring with 2 minutes left to go on the clock in football is the easiest thing to do in sports. It really is.
That was an impressive drive. I'm not taking that drive. I'm not saying he's good or he'll be good.
Well, the touchdown pass was pretty impressive, too.
Yeah.
But still, the 92 yards is the longest Cleveland Browns drive of the year, and Tim's right. Okay. The drive in its entirety is impressive, and the touchdown pass is impressive, but the first 60 or 70 yards are attained differently than they are if there's 8 minutes left.
Well, all right, it's year two. He's made four starts in the NFL.
I'll bet you right now that he does not start against the Steelers.
That'd be so dumb. What else do you have to play for? You drafted Manziel. You might as well at least find out about
it. Cleveland-Pittsburgh pride, Ken. Cleveland-Pittsburgh pride.
We want to play Daniel Sprong, but you don't advocate the Browns playing Johnny Manziel?
There's a difference between advocating them playing. Yes, I would say go ahead and play him. Your season's washed up anyway. See what you got. Let the whole world know you made a mistake and then move on and try to get your 23rd quarterback since you've come back into existence.
And Johnny Manziel's closer to proving he can't play than Daniel Sprong is at this point, too.
Oh, he's made four starts. I mean, he's had a lot of off-the-field issues, which have derailed him.
Have you been a Manziel guy the whole time? Have you thought that?
No. I thought Bridgewater would be better. Well, last year I wanted him to play ahead of Hoyer because Hoyer was bad for a couple games, and me and Taylor got into this big screaming match about it for no reason. And Taylor was wrong, as always, because there was no reason to keep playing Hoyer last year either. He was awful. And might as well try Manziel. If you took the guy, you might as well at least see what you got. I
mean, you say you wanted him from a Browns perspective? You thought it was smarter? Is that what you're saying?
I just thought at the time Hoyer was so bad. You remember that game against the Colts where he was like, Hoyer was terrible. He had like 15 incompletions in a row or something. And it was like, and the Browns had a good start. But at some point, it came to, why not see what this guy can do? And then he didn't do anything, and he was bad. But are you ready to give up on him? I mean, after four starts?
I don't think this coach thinks he's all that good. I don't think this coach has ever thought he's all that good.
Agreed. But that's the only thing keeping him employed, this coach. So if I'm Mike Pettine, I'd say, yeah, I want to work with Johnny Manziel. Let's see what he can do. Might buy me another year of my career.
I hope he starts against the Steelers for the Steelers' sake, not the Browns' sake. Please let him start.
What's the Browns' record now? They're 2-6.
Yes.
Why would you put Josh McCown back in? What would be the point? They almost traded Joe Thomas. I mean, they've given up.
I don't care that much about the Browns.
But
I agree with you that the idea of starting him from their perspective is the better thing to do. To just go ahead and announce to the world it's over. Look at him.
They're 2-7.
Look at how bad he is.
2-7.
So, yeah, go ahead and play him, but I don't think he's any good. If you're thinking like starting Johnny Manziel is going to help them win, you're wrong.
I don't think he's any good, but that 92-yard drive showed me a little bit of Russell Wilson, and I would see what I got for the rest of the year.
It's a two-minute drive in the first half. You know, the worst team in football can score against the best team in football these days with a two-minute drive. It's the easiest thing to do in sports is score with 2 minutes left.
look, the guy made some throws in college. That's not everything. But he had some talent. I know he had some weapons there. He had Mike Evans. It was
Flutie.
The SEC. The guy beat Alabama. I mean,
Flutie won the Heisman. He had talent, too. And it didn't work here in the NFL.
Okay. Well, Russell Wilson was good at NC State and Wisconsin. And then he came to the pros and he went to a Super Bowl and won it. So just because the guy is short of stature and a little bit atypical doesn't mean you would give up on him after four starts.
Drew Brees is short of stature, too. There's about 25 teams in the league would take him.
It's not just about being short. It's about what you can and can't do with your height. You know, so, yeah, Drew Brees is short. He stands in the pocket, throws the ball straight up in the air, and it goes deep downfield with accuracy.
Right.
Does Johnny Manziel do that?
That looked like an accurate pass in the end zone on the touchdown.
I'll differ with you there. He had a reach behind him. That was a great catch. He's running to the corner of the end zone. He had to turn completely the opposite way to get the ball behind him. That was more receiver than quarterback.
All right. I don't know why I've become the defend Johnny Manziel guy.
Yeah, no kidding. I don't get it either.
Well, somebody's got to at least say, hey, at least he showed something. I mean, I'm just saying he's worth another start next week. I don't get McCown playing against the Steelers. We can ask these things of Rob Rossi. I do want to get Rossi's take on the Narduzzi comments about Notre Dame and the Pitt-Notre Dame game. And we'll ask him about the net size in the NHL, of course. We didn't ask him any Penguin stuff on Wednesday.
He was relieved.
Was he relieved or offended?
No, I think he's relieved because they had been winning.
Okay.
Remember at the end of it, he said, then for the first time in weeks, you didn't ask me any Penguin stuff. Thank you.
Good. Oh, it's true. He did say that. All right. Well, he's rested up. He's recovered. He had his bye week. Trip columnist Rob Rossi will join us next. We're brought to you by Duffy's Beer and much more in Pleasant Hills at 412-653-BEER and all of our weekly specials at duffysbeer.com. By the way, Tim has some Pirates hot stove nuggets he wants to pass on in the next hour as well.
Yeah, I can't believe with your looking through the lens, the telescope that you've had for the Pirates and who they're going to sign to replace Jay Happ, you didn't come up with this name because it's perfect.
Better than Bud Norris?
Better than Bud Norris. Okay. God, I hope he's better than Bud Norris.
Cheers to the Bud Norrises and the Johnny Manziels and the Rob Rossies of the world, and they'll join us next.
Duffy's Beer and much more in Pleasant Hills, 412-653-BEER. See all of our weekly specials at duffysbeer.com. Bud, Bud Light, and Coors Light 30-pack cans, only $18.99. Plus Miller Lite and Yingling 24-pack cans for only $14.99. Winter and Christmas beers are arriving daily. Give the gift of good cheer this Christmas with a gift card to Duffy's, your South Hills headquarters for beer, pop, snacks, vapes, home brewing supplies, and all your party and tailgating needs for this week's game. Duffy's Beer and much more in Pleasant Hills, online at duffysbeer.com.